although UNRWA is feeding over 2 million desperately poor and fragile and vulnerable refugees across the region, it has to suddenly provide services for, frankly, over 2 million people in Gaza today.
Israel had an antipathy, the state of Israel had an antipathy towards UNRWA from the very, very start. One might also almost say it had a hate on right from the very, very beginning.
It did.
And that antipathy was reflected towards Count Folk Bernadotte, who really was the one who kind of brought it about. Tell me about Count Folk Bernadotte.
So Bernadotte, I think his story illustrates five things. Here was a man who early on was a visionary, and he realized that the refugees had rights, and they had a whole panoply of rights which are embodied in the Universal Declaration. And Count Bernadotte realized very early on that unless and until the rights and all the rights of the refugees were properly respected and implemented, that the Middle East would remain an inherently unstable place, because you'd have this huge population of people whose rights had not been respected. But he also realized that Israel would be an inherently unviable state and would remain in a state of insecurity unless and until it respected the refugees' rights. So just to illustrate, you know, what I was saying earlier about Bernadotte, his story elucidating so much of what is relevant today. First of all, his story illustrates the triumph of the extremists and extremism in Israel. So, you know, it was a member of the Stern Gang with which the future Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir was associated that executed, that murdered, I should say. Execution has a legalistic connotation, and it was a murder, it was an assassination.
And I think it was actually Leahy, not the Stern Gang.
Well, they are more or less the same thing, I think it was fair to say. The Leahy, yeah, you're right. The Israeli government persisted in covering up the Stern Gang's involvement in the killing as well. They were involved. But my point is that it's extremism, and it's the extremists within Israel who set the agenda and the murder of Bernadotte, just as today in Israel we're seeing the extremists setting the agenda. Secondly, we're seeing the predominance of Israeli lies and disinformation, just as in the late 1940s the Israelis lied to the General Assembly about who reported on the killing of Bernadotte. The Israelis lied about the involvement of several members of the Lehi. And indeed, it wasn't until after the statute of limitation for murder expired in 1968, so these people were beyond the arm of the law, that they actually admitted their involvement.
And it's important to note out for listeners that Count Folk Bernadotte submitted his plan, the Bernadotte Plan, to the United Nations, laying the groundwork for UNRWA and the right of return on September 16th, 1948.
Exactly.
September 16th, 1948. The next day, September 17th, he was assassinated.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, I think it's, this precisely illustrates the points that I'm making. The third point I wanted to make about the way that Bernadotte's life and his ideas illustrate what's happening today, the impunity. So I've mentioned the extremism predominating, I've mentioned the Israeli lies which they told about, you know, covering up what they were doing, which is so much a feature of what's happening today, with so much disinformation about the conflict being spread by Israel. But thirdly, the impunity. And what you saw was, for example, Yehoshua Cohen, who was the man who actually murdered Bernadotte, he went on to be given a very prominent job by Ben-Gurion, the Israeli prime minister. And of course, Yitzhak Shamir went on to become the prime minister. So, you know, and what we're seeing again today is impunity. Although we are, you know, I think things have changed now. We've got the International Court of Justice accusing Israel of plausible genocide and making it quite clear that Netanyahu, the prime minister, the defense minister, Yoav Gallant, and Yitzhak Herzog, the president, are actually guilty of inciting genocide. And in the case of Yoav Gallant, who's called for a complete blockade of Gaza. He stands accused of genocide, of perpetrating starvation as the occupying power on a people that Israel, under international law, the Geneva Conventions, is obliged to protect. Fourthly, the fourth way that Bernadotte's life, I think, illustrates what's going on today is Bernadotte was very clear that the refugees had rights. And, you know, from this, one can extrapolate that although he was giving UNRWA its mandate and that UNRWA's mandate was linked to this idea of refugee rights, Bernadotte was very clear that these are human beings and these are human beings with rights. And in a sense, it doesn't matter whether UNRWA exists or not. And this is me talking, not Count Bernadotte. It doesn't matter whether UNRWA exists. These are people with inalienable rights. And that those rights include the right of return. And whether UNRWA exists or not, those rights must be and ultimately will have to be respected. And whether Israel and the far right in Israel rejects them or not, be very clear, you cannot airbrush out of history either a people's collective memories of their homeland, of where they came from, of their identity. But you can, neither can you airbrush out of the international discourse their status as refugees and their rights of refugees. And, you know, those ideas go back very much to the thinking of Count Bernadotte. You know, very, very lastly, you know, and the last fifth point I would make about the way that Bernadotte's life illustrates all this, at a time when there is clear talk in Israel about driving 2.3 million people from Gaza into the Sinai, into Egypt, and forcing them out of historic Palestine, Bernadotte would tell you, if he was alive today and on this podcast, that it doesn't matter where the refugees are. They could be in Switzerland, they could be in Canada. The right of return is a right enshrined in the universal jurisdiction. And it doesn't matter where on the planet anybody is, that right pertains. So, you know, Israel and the far right can try and airbrush out of history these refugees' rights. It can attempt to ethnically cleanse them and force them into the Sinai. It can do all of those things. And it, sadly, it seems like the Security Council, the Americans and the Brits, they're giving logistical support, financial support, political support, diplomatic support. And so, you know, it's possible that these things may happen. Who knows? But the fact is that even if these things do happen, Count Bernadotte's essential point lives through the decades. And that is that wherever they are, they have the full gamut of rights as embodied in the Universal Declaration. They have group rights, they have individual rights, and those rights include the right of return.
But I mean, this is the core of the matter, the internal core of Israel's antipathy towards Haidon for UNRWA that goes back 40 years prior to the emergence of Hamas, which emerged in 1987. UNRWA emerged like 1949, and Israel wanted the refugees, those 750,000 people they'd driven out, Israel wanted them to vanish. It wanted them to go away and not even not return, but not even think about returning. And so UNRWA kind of perpetuated this idea that the Palestinians have a right to return, and even worse, kind of helped them stay where they were with that hope in mind.
Of course, that's not true, right? UNRWA does not perpetuate the refugee crisis. What perpetuates the refugee crisis is the failure of Israel and the failure of the international community to resolve the rights of the refugees in the context of a just and durable solution. UNRWA would go away and the refugees, their rights would be resolved if they were to be granted, as all people deserve and must have, the right of self-determination. So it is a myth, and it's a myth perpetrated by the Israeli far right now, that somehow UNRWA is the problem. UNRWA is the obstacle to peace. If only UNRWA would go away, then the refugee issue would be resolved. That is not true. The refugee problem is perpetuated and remains a problem because Israel and the international community have failed to resolve the refugee problem in the context of a just and durable solution. And that's why, you know, one of my more optimistic and probably completely ill-founded hopes is that one of the lessons of 7/10, of the attack on the 7th of October, is that Israel will realize that the myth, if you like, that Israel could manage the Palestinian question, that has evaporated. The myth that Israel could impose an apartheid system on the West Bank, could arrest children and torture them in the middle of the night, could do school demolitions and home demolitions, could impose a blockade on Gaza, could now commit a plausible genocide against Gaza, and still somehow be guaranteed its security. That myth has disappeared. Israelis have learnt that there is always the risk of a 7th of October attack if they think they can continue to manage the Palestinian issue. What they've surely just woken up to is the idea that they have to resolve the Palestinian question, not manage it. And on the Palestinian side, I hope that they have learned that they need to grant Israel its security. Now, there's an irony that, you know, an organization considered fringe and isolated and a terrorist organization, which, you know, part of Hamas clearly is, though Hamas is a political movement and far more. But the idea that that political movement, that terrorist organization, characterize Hamas however you will, that that needs to grant the state with the most powerful army in the Middle East, it needs to grant Israel security. And only when there is that rather asymmetric realization will the Palestinians have a state, the right to self-determination, their right to development and prosperity and justice and accountability, all those things. And conversely, only at that point will Israel be granted its security. And I would like to think that one of the things that will come out of the appalling events of what's happened since 7th of October is that there will be this realization that the two peoples are interdependent, they are neighbors, and the only way that they can actually have the Israelis' security, the Palestinians a viable state, is if they are two parties who talk to each other, and part of that conversation has to be a resolution of the refugee question. That doesn't mean that every single, you know, Palestinian refugee would necessarily come back and, you know, live in Israel. There are many different ways the right of return can be implemented, compensation, reparations, call it what you will. But I hope that one of the things that might ultimately come out of the appalling events of the last 4 months will be that realization and therefore genuine moves towards a two-state solution. And that's why, obviously, Netanyahu has to go, because he so opposes a two-state solution. And let's hope that on the Palestinian side, perhaps Marwan Barghouti will be released. Let's see if a visionary leader, a sort of Palestinian Nelson Mandela, will emerge who can lead the Palestinians towards a just and durable solution. That's a pipe dream, but I don't think it's one that we should dismiss out of hand.
But I mean, just to put a fine point on this, I'm looking at a press release from B'nai B'rith Canada, B'nai B'rith Canada, that refers to itself as a staunch defender of the State of Israel. This is something that it published in February of 2021. It says, unlike the UNHCR, UNRWA does not seek to solve the Palestinian refugee problem, but rather to perpetuate it as a political weapon against Israel by, among other things, insisting on a claim of the right of return to the Jewish state for those uniquely designated as Palestinian refugees. I mean, this is their core problem with UNRWA, isn't it?
Who's B'nai B'rith? Sorry, but who's B'nai B'rith? And what right do they have to pronounce upon issues of international law, of refugee rights? On what basis do they possibly have the right? I suspect they are a politically motivated organization that, like so many around the world, are doing the bidding of the far right in Israel. I don't know the extent to which they speak for any Jews or Israelis, let alone the Palestinians, and certainly not for international law, if those are the sorts of views they are going to be espousing, because those views are absolutely wrong in terms of the law, certainly, because, as I say, UNRWA refugees have rights, and it doesn't matter whether UNHCR is looking after them, the other refugee agency in the UN system, or UNRWA is. My point is that refugees have three choices. They can have integration where they are, they have the choice to go to a third country, or they have the right of return. And UNHCR offers refugees exactly those choices, And by the way, UNHCR's preferred remedy, as they call it, is the right of return. Why? Because in their long experience since 1951 of dealing with refugees, the right of return produces the most stable outcome. It's much more stable for erstwhile enemies to go back home and to learn to live with the people who drove them out and who turned them into refugees. So it doesn't matter, you know, whether they're UNHCR administered or UNRWA administered. The fact is that those refugees would have the right of return, and UNHCR's preferred remedy is the right of return. There is a myth that UNHCR exclusively offers refugees resettlement in a third country, and if you give the refugees to UNHCR, they'll pack them off to Canada and to goodness knows where. That is a myth. It's a deliberate misunderstanding of UNRWA's mandate and UNHCR's mandate. It's a deliberate politicization of the issue in support of far-right dreams in Israel, which frankly are ill-founded, and they're not going to happen. I mean, you know, that's what B'nai B'rith needs to get used to. It is not speaking with any authority in terms of international law. It is doing, from what I can understand, the bidding of the most far-right government in the history of Israel.
Well, let me jump in here. I mean, with another, and forgive me, here's another quote of theirs from just December 1st, 2023, this past December, and you've heard these charges before. As B'nai B'rith has warned repeatedly, there is strong evidence that the organization's schools have become conduits for violent incitement. Educational materials such as textbooks used in UNRWA schools are rife with anti-Semitic caricatures, rhetoric glorifying terrorism, and promoting the erasure of the Israeli state. I mean, this is the burning inner core of Israel's hate on, isn't it?
I mean, that's just wrong. I mean, I don't know why we're even discussing this. These are lies which are put out by groups that are doing the bidding of the most far-right government in the history of Israel. The United States Government Auditing Office, the GAO, did a root and branch audit of UNRWA. UNRWA is the most audited agency in the history of the United Nations. And in, I think it was 2019, the GAO came to UNRWA, I was there, did a root and branch audit of UNRWA, including its textbook, its neutrality frameworks, everything. And guess what? America carried on funding UNRWA to the tune of $350 million a year. Does B'nai B'rith, whoever they are, think that if there was any truth to their assertion that UNRWA was preaching the eradication of Israel, that the American government would continue funding UNRWA to the tune of $350 million? I mean, I don't know what planet these people are on, but it's not the same one as I'm on, and it's not the same one that, you know, those who understand international law understand the running of UNRWA. And let me be clear, they are part, I suspect, of this echo chamber. There are groups like UN Watch, like Human Rights Monitor, like Impact SE, who are, as I say, doing the bidding today of the far-right government of Israel. Impact SE and UN Watch, they once did this massive critique of UNRWA's curriculum, and guess what? They got the wrong curriculum. They were actually not talking about the PA, the Palestinian Authority curriculum, which is taught by UNRWA in Gaza and the West Bank. They were talking about the Jordanian and the Egyptian curriculum. That's how trustworthy these groups are.
Now, we only have about 5 minutes left here, 5 or 6 minutes, Chris. I'd like to talk about the current situation in Gaza, which is it's really surreal. We're hearing about imminent famine.
It's not imminent. It's not imminent. It is going on now.
Aid delivery, you know, not getting through, you know, aid trucks being fired on. But Israel says, of course, Israel says it does not impose limits on aid shipments. It's aid agencies and humanitarian organizations who are to blame. And yet we're seeing this constantly, the disaster that's unfolding, the famine.
That's sick. This is all sick. This is sick stuff. The idea that the occupying power that since 2007 has imposed this appallingly illegal collective punishment on Gaza, and since the 7th of October has been restricting humanitarian aid at the instructions of its defense minister. Let's be clear, this comes from Yoav Gallant, who said there should be no water, no fuel, no food. So you don't have to, you know, you don't have to look for whether it's true or not. It's at the orders of the man who is in charge of the Israeli army. The idea that this organization, which has imposed on Gaza this extraordinary restriction of a, in violation of the provisional measures ordered by the ICJ, the highest court in the world, on the 26th of January, which is very clear, there can be no restrictions on humanitarian aid. Before the 7th of October, UNRWA was taking in 500 trucks a day. That is now well under 100. And that is going on because the Israelis are restricting it. And for them to say that it's the aid organizations like UNRWA, who they have mounted a political attack against. And let's be clear, on the last day of February, we saw the pictures of the IDF shooting at people coming to collect aid in the middle of the night. The most powerful army in the Middle East shooting at people against whom they are imposing and inflicting mass starvation. They are blaming the aid organizations and the people of Gaza for that. I'm sorry, that is sick. There is no other word to describe it.
And the UN Office of Internal Oversight has just released a report, and they're going to be coming out with another one in March, I think. And they disclose that there's no evidence. Actually, they've been unable to uncover any evidence to corroborate Israel's charges.
Exactly. I mean, here you have the Israeli authorities pushed into this echo chamber I just described, which has all these groups like UN Watch and Impact SE, etc. The New York Times is very much not so much part of that echo chamber. It's the loudspeaker of that echo chamber. The New York Times splashed across its front pages these allegations, which they bought hook, like they swallowed hook, line and sinker. And that led 16 donors to UNRWA to defund the agency to the tune of half a billion dollars. And guess what? Here we are a month on. There's been an investigation by the highest investigative office of the United Nations, independent of UNRWA, by the way, because the last OIOS report saw the former Commissioner General of UNRWA effectively forced out of the agency. He resigned, but because of an OIOS report into financial misdoings and a sexual scandal. So the OIOS, let's be clear, are independent and authoritative. They have found no evidence to corroborate the Israeli dossier, the intelligence dossier. Even the Americans have said that they have low confidence in this intelligence. And it's clear that the Brits, the Australians, that all the donors, none of the donors, had proper evidence when they made the decision to defund UNRWA. And I would say that those donors, rather than, I mean, yes, there should be a spotlight put on the neutrality frameworks in UNRWA, there should be also a spotlight shone on the neutrality frameworks of the donors, because they have allowed politics to influence their humanitarian decision-making. And that is a violation of the humanitarian principles of neutrality and impartiality. So, A, those donors, on the strength of this OIOS report, they need to refund. This OIOS report, which has found no wrongdoing, has not corroborated the Israeli allegations. That is a ladder on which all of these donors who've defunded UNRWA can climb down. They must immediately refund UNRWA, because guess what? If they do not do that, they will find themselves complicit in starvation, complicit in genocide, and guilty of supporting the political agenda of the most far-right government in the history of Israel. Does Andrew Mitchell, the UK development minister, does David Cameron, the UK foreign secretary, does Antony Blinken, do the Trudeau administration, do they really want to find themselves being judged by history to have been complicit in genocide and starvation? Because to be clear, you said starvation was imminent. It isn't imminent. It is going on right now. Starvation is a slow motion massacre. And that massacre, as we saw on the last day of February, that massacre has begun.
And if funding is not restored to UNRWA and UNRWA collapses, if UNRWA is no longer able to deliver services in Gaza, what will be the consequences for the Gazan population, who are already suffering hugely?
A humanitarian catastrophe will become a humanitarian apocalypse. There's no doubt in my mind at all about that. UNRWA is, with its 13,000 staff and its warehouses and its food distribution centres, that UNRWA is the only game in town that can stave off the starvation that is taking place right now. And what we're seeing is 2.3 million people as a result of direct political choices, Western governments doing the political bidding of Israel. We are seeing that starvation taking place as a result of direct political choices. This is not like the Ethiopian famine in the mid-1980s. This is not a natural disaster. This is a political choice which our governments are taking. And people of conscience all around the world need to tell their governments, tell their elected representatives that they do not want to be complicit in genocide and starvation. This madness, this slow motion massacre of the people of Gaza has to end. Already, the UN is saying that more people are likely to die of starvation than because of these 2,000 pound bombs that Israel is dropping in Gaza in violation of international law. So we need to end the immorality and this madness and the impunity and the violations of international law. You know, this is the first time in history that the world has a live-streamed genocide.
And Israel's targeting of UNRWA really is aimed at advancing its, if I may say so, genocidal objectives.
I agree. I mean, the destruction of UNRWA is part of a political grand scheme, which is, you know, redolent of some of the worst excesses of the 20th century in order to eliminate a people and their rights. And of course, we all know from the history of the Second World War that that is impossible, that ultimately a people's right to self-determination will triumph. You know, I went on the anti-Semitism marches in London and chanted with the rest of the crowd, "Never again." Well, "never again" is a universal cry. Of course, it applies to the Jews, but it also applies to the Palestinians.
Chris Gunness, thank you for joining me on the Green Planet Monitor.
It's a pleasure to be with you. Thank you very much for having me.
Chris Gunness is former spokesperson for the UN Relief and Works Agency, UNRWA. Read more about UNRWA, Count Folk Bernadotte, and Gaza at greenplanetmonitor.net. That's it for today's GPM, a listener-supported podcast coming to you from Earth Chronicle Productions in the Netherlands. Listen to, read, and watch more Earth stories at greenplanetmonitor.net. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube, and our home base, Blueberry. We're also on Facebook and Twitter, and Canada's Harbinger Media Network. Wherever or however you're listening, reading, or watching, please help us make the GPM happen. Subscribe and or donate at greenplanetmonitor.net. By the way, the guy behind this guitar is Dan Weisenberger. Thanks for your brilliant instrumental themes, Dan. I'm David Kattenberg. Over and out. For now.
And you know what that means. It's les rendezvous de la francophonie.
Check out rvf.ca to discover all the activities and contests happening across Canada.